Hello, and welcome to part two of Middle East Analysis. Two of four, I must say, so you've got plenty more to come. Split it up, have a cup of tea, do whatever you want in the meantime. But do listen to us for this segment on Egypt. I don't know where to start. Muslim Brotherhood sit-in, President Morsi, take it away, you start.
Egypt is in a very bizarre situation at the moment. What is very interesting is that the huge popular uprisings against an incumbent president who had been there for 1 year only and elected for that started at the end of June by a grassroots movement called Tamarrud. And Tamarrud means rebellion. And what the people were doing, millions upon millions upon millions of Egyptians were signing petitions and demonstrating in the streets against a president who was not only seen to be incompetent and unable to run the country, but one who was also aligning himself fully with his own political Islamist party, the Muslim Brotherhood, and excluding everybody else from the political scenario. Or at least that was how most Egyptians perceived it at the time. They thought this man is basically Islamicizing the country according to the narrative of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is unacceptable. And in the process, the economy is growing weaker and weaker, and the situation is getting worse and worse. So they went out in the streets, and we know the story now. On the 3rd of July, which is a key date, the Minister of Defense, El-Sisi, came up and basically said he's taking over. Now, I've heard so many euphemisms: taking over, ouster of the president, deposal of the president, a coup against the president. It doesn't matter. The fact remains that the president is no longer president, and that there is now a new president, so-called Mansour Adli, and there is a new government that is trying to prepare the way for amending the constitution, holding new presidential and legislative or parliamentary elections. Now, until now, I would have said, fine, this is a bit unusual. It's unusual in the sense that for me as an international lawyer, but as somebody who also would argue for the legality of a democratic process, the idea that the majority of Egyptians, if we can call it that, didn't want him and wanted to get rid of him, and then they said to the army, look, we won't be able to do it alone, could you give us a hand? And the army basically made sure that he no longer was present. He was taken to a secure residence somewhere else in Cairo. All this would have been acceptable in the rough and tumble of political life in Egypt, were it not for the fact that after that, there has been a continuous standoff between the army and those forces that are against the ex-president or the former president, and the Muslim Brotherhood people who've been sitting in at Rabi al-Adawiyya in one of the squares in Cairo, constantly saying we will not budge from here until the president is brought back to his office and recognized again as president. So we have this very, very difficult and very dangerous situation where two polarities, two masses in Egypt, those still supporting the ex-president and those who don't, who in my opinion are the majority of Egyptians, they are basically at a standoff, staring at each other. There have been violent episodes from both sides, which is not only lamentable but unacceptable. And we are at a situation where the European Union, the African League, many people are trying to find a way out that would basically not see the economy of Egypt crumble further, and that will avoid Egypt with all its constituents, the liberals, the Christians, the Muslims, the Salafists, everybody coming together and moving forward, rather than basically causing a war of attrition between two camps in the country.
Isn't it alarming, though, the level of violence? I mean, I would have to question whether that square can actually be cleared without atrocities. to be quite honest with you?
Well, let me answer this in two ways. There has been violence. It has not been really alarming. Yes, I mean, some people might take me up on this and say, how can you even say that when there have been 50 people killed? Yes, but I agree with that. And believe you me, every life in every part of the Middle East, North Africa is sacred for me, as I'm sure it is for you. But I'm talking in the larger context of things. If, for instance, we compare what's happening in Iraq, which we'll touch in one of our podcast today, what's happening in Syria compared to what's happening in the huge country called Egypt, it is not yet at a critical level, but it is at a level where the green light has turned to amber. And what I worry about is that the amber would then turn into red, and that's where we are in a difficult situation. But would the army be able to vacate the sit-in protesters in the square? I believe not. I mean, the government has already asked the Minister of Interior and the police to try and get rid of those people. But you're talking about tens of thousands upon tens of thousands of people. And actually doing that would be well nigh impossible without more confrontation, without more bloodbaths, without more so-called martyrs resulting from the confrontation. So in a sense, for me, in the Israel-Palestine context, I gave you my three stages of what needs to be done that is different from what has been done to date on that level. I will tell you the same thing, James, with Egypt. For me, it is no longer a question of former President Mohamed Morsi coming back. I think we're past that stage. He bungled it up. In my opinion, if I rate him, I would rate him as a failed president. But the question is, where do we go from here? Where we go from here is very simple. We need to have a process where we have new elections for a new president, where we have new elections for a new parliament, but where we also have an amendment of the Constitution, particularly those problematic provisions that were added in the Constitution by President Morsi and his party, which had the majority seats in Parliament at the time for the past year. That, to me, is the process that needs to move forward with Egypt. But it also has to be an inclusive process. I've been hearing very worrying noises, sometimes from the army, which asks the people of Egypt to give it a mandate to run the country. Excuse me, we don't want the army to have a mandate to run the country. The whole revolution of 25 January was to get rid not only of President Hosni Mubarak, but of the army, and to have a popular, democratically elected government. There are others who are saying, no, what we actually need is not the army. What we actually need is to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood completely and have a country minus the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, excuse me, for a movement that has been building itself up slowly, gradually, some would say surreptitiously, for 80 years, and which has enough grassroots and popular support, you cannot suddenly say, we don't want you anymore in the political process. One, because it is counterintuitive politically to do that. Secondly, because it would prove to the Muslim Brotherhood what they have almost always suspected, which is if we go back into the political process, we will be checkmated. And we don't want that. We want them to be part of the political process. And the third one is, and the most sinister in my opinion, if you say to them you're excluded from the political process and they have a huge following, as we've seen in the protests across Egypt, they will go underground as well. And that is even worse for Egypt and for the process and for the future ahead. So an inclusive way forward, amendment of the Constitution, elections for president and parliament, and the continuation of the support that the European Union, the United States, with its 1.3 billion annual aid to the country, continues, so that we do not see another major country. And Egypt is not just any tinpot country. It's an important country with a multi-ethnic component beginning to come undone.
Talking about that multi-ethnic component, though, I have a slight anxiety over the position of the Christians in the country. Mm-hmm. We go back to the Cross and the Crescent in Tahrir Square, where maybe naively I felt a bit of a sort of, you know, swell of unity and excitement, actually. Now it seems, when you look at the joint statement from the churches on the Constitution, not brilliantly well received. Are they being marginalised somewhat, and therefore their legitimate part in society not being recognised in Egypt?
I think it's very important. As far as the Christians are concerned in Egypt, and they are roughly about 10 or 12% maximum of the overall population, but that's quite substantial in Middle East and North African terms. And they constitute largely, they are Copts, Orthodox mostly, but also Catholic and Evangelical. And you also have, incidentally, very ancient but small Greek Orthodox and Armenian Orthodox communities in the country as well. It's a difficult moment because I've always argued that in any kind of democracy, whether it's a democracy the way we've got it in this country, flawed as it is, or a democracy in the Middle East, North Africa, which is a nascent concept for many people, one that the Arab intellectuals have been talking about and writing about for years and years, one of the most important things is equal representation. That equal representation is important, but there is also a psychology. The psychology is that the Middle East, North Africa is, whether nominally or practically, majority Muslim. And therefore, given the history over the past so many decades of those countries, whether it is in Egypt or in any of the other countries of the region, of tensions between Christians and Muslims, I think it behoves well upon the Christian leaders, be it of Egypt or of any other country, to be careful how they deal with the political instances and the political developments in the country so as not to exacerbate people's reactions. At the moment, it's almost like a tinderbox, James. The major tinderbox is between two parties, two groups of people. But within those groups, there's so many different groups. There are the women, there are the liberals, there are the seculars, there are the Salafists, there are the Muslim Brothers, and there are the Christians. And the Christians should be very careful that their voice is heard, but that they do not do it in such a way as it would seem that they are trying to shift the dynamics of the country so much that it would actually create a counter-reaction from most of those Muslims who are involved in the process as well. I know it's what I'm saying is very nuanced, it's very subtle, and some people would accuse me of basically being bizarre in the way I'm portraying the role that Christians have to play. But let me put it more simply than that for you. We, in our faith, believe that we have a ministry of reconciliation, a ministry of bridge building. That bridge building and that reconciliation expresses itself through an inclusive rather than an exclusive sense of interest.
It's almost like you're saying 12%, yes, significant, not massive, but definitely significant. Have your 12% of the say, don't overstretch yourself.
You said it, I didn't.
You're listening to Dr. Harry Hagopian on Middle East Analysis. This is part two. Harry is our Middle East North Africa consultant to the Bishops of England and Wales. Part two, Egypt. Part three, Harry, I think we'll move on to Syria. How can we not?
We will move on to Syria, but before we do, let me also leave in the political imagination of our listeners one point which I'm sure you will have raised as well with me. And that is to look at Egypt, and when looking at Egypt, also to look at other countries in the Middle East, North Africa. And the two countries I would actually single out are Tunisia and Libya. Because a lot is happening in Tunisia and a lot is happening in Libya that is an indication of the tensions building up in those countries. It's very interesting in Tunisia because Ennahda is the leading party, and it's an Islamist party that's the equivalent of the Justice and Development Party or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They're under a lot of pressure as well because of the assassinations of Shukri Belaid and now of Brahmi. And therefore, for our listeners not to look at Egypt only in an insular, sanitized way, but to look at Egypt and then to look down the road from Egypt on the map to Libya and Tunisia and do the comparisons as to how the whole region is either coming together or getting undone. Famous analysts like Hussein Ibish, for instance, from Washington, D.C., have written a lot about how the Muslim Brotherhood is pretty much weakening to the stage of it being splintered, that it had its moment within the so-called Arab Spring, but that that moment has gone. I wouldn't go so far as to use that argument that Hussein Ibish is using. I would say that it has had a few reversals, certainly in Egypt. We're seeing it also in Libya and Tunisia. Incidentally, we're seeing it in Gaza. Gaza suddenly saw itself an important player in the political scene, and now it's yet again hunkering down because of the changes across the region. So all I'm saying to our listeners, James, please look at the region. Yes, we're looking at them one by one, but there is still an interconnectedness of the various phenomena that define what makes the Middle East, North Africa tick.
Well, I'm very well put as well. And one, it just strikes me that none of these countries or states have been boxed away nicely. Uprising, everything's great, boxed away. You used the phrase growing pains, and I think that's what it is.
It's absolutely.
It's a rebirth, but my goodness, there's going to be some growing pains.
It is a rebirth, and I'll tell you what, I still, if you ask me, and if you haven't, but I'll put myself in a corner, and if I were to say, Harry, in your opinion, which country is the one that has had the most successful change in relative terms to date?
Good question.
Despite all the problems, and there have been very serious problems in the country recently, I would say that Tunisia still leads the pack.
Very interesting. And you're right to put that alongside Egypt as well.
Absolutely.
And Libya. Harry, thank you very much. That's
pleasure.
Part two. As I say, we are going to move on to Syria. Plenty to talk about. If you want to catch Harry on Twitter, by the way, you can do that. It's at Harry Hagopian. And again, little plug for the church, as I would love to do as well. That's at Catholic EW. Please come and follow us if you're not doing so already. So you have time to catch your breath, make a cup of tea, do the ironing, do whatever you want to do. Go and lie in the sunshine. It's lovely. Then come back and we'll be back with our discussion on Syria.